And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great show for you this week. We're going to be catching up on the news. We're going to give you a really good tip of the week on mobile security and 10 things you can do to really turn up the volume on your security and privacy for your mobile phone. And this week's deep dive is going to be DNA privacy. And we are going to dive in deep, looking at the laws on the books that protect our genetic identities, the loopholes that you know we are now discovering that the law doesn't cover, as well as several different updates to news that is not necessarily going to make you a fan of DNA testing, but it's something we all need to talk about. So settle in. It's going to be a great hour. And as always, we're going to start with the news. In data breach news, we are talking about Adams County, Wisconsin. Now, if you are not familiar with Adams County, Wisconsin, they are just north of the Wisconsin Dells. And I know that I do have listeners in Wisconsin, so heads up, guys, this may actually affect you or possibly people around the state. Now, Adams County is a small county. They have a population of about 20,000 users or so, they have a population of about 20 users. And they just declared a data breach. And it is a massive data breach because those 20,000 in that population were not just affected. 258,120 individuals were affected by this. Now, this vulnerability has been there and persistent for 6 years, from January 2013 to March of 2018. And basically, they had brought in an IT individual to do some work. He had discovered, that basically there's maliciousness, data exfiltration, all this kind of stuff going on. And so they did a forensic cybersecurity analysis and found out that pretty much everything was breached. Personal information, tax information, personal health information on hundreds of thousands of people were breached. And this actually underscores a problem that we have in society today, specifically the U.S. government. While we have data compliance laws for security and all of this, what ends up happening is a lot of local and state governments that are supposed to be adhering to these compliance laws don't necessarily do that. And when they are, you know, short on budget or don't have the money, one of the first things to go is technology, which means they are not keeping up with current cyber defense strategies, aka compliance law. Then we end up with things like Adams, Wisconsin. So people in Adams, Wisconsin, I am sorry for you, and I hope it gets remediated quickly. Now, Adams County has also come out and said that they have learned of no personal identity theft scams or anything like that based off of the data that was exposed. However, that they really can't say that. They're not 100% going to know. And if data had been exfiltrating from that network for 6 years, then it's very possible several different identity theft scams and all of that have stemmed from that. And I can't imagine that not a single person in Adams County or surrounding counties, hasn't had a identity theft scam. So take that for what it's worth. But that is your data breach news of the week. And in artificial intelligence news, basically, researchers have been looking into how AI can affect emotions. And what they've done is they actually did a study to see if humans would be able to feel sympathy or empathy for artificial intelligence. We know, obviously, it's a robot. It doesn't have feelings. But if it mimics emotions, what's going to happen? So they created a robot called Nao. That's N-A-O. And they had 89 participants in this study. 43 of these participants basically got one set of directions and the other 43 did not. Now, these 43 we're going to talk about, they were told by the researchers, okay, interact with the robot, play with the robot, talk to the robot, etc. And at the very end of it, and this is what these 43 got that the others didn't, was basically to say, hey, go ahead and flip the switch and turn off the robot, to end the session. And interestingly enough, these 43 then basically now responded saying, no, please don't, please don't turn me off. I'm afraid of the dark. What if I don't turn back on? I don't want to die. Basically just really playing it up, pleading with the person. And of the 43, 13 people actually refused to shut the robot off. And they had cited like, well, I didn't know, like I didn't want to break it or, you know, I felt bad for it, or I wanted to see, you know, if it would continue interacting with me if I switched it off. You know, there's a whole range, but people actually felt empathy and sympathy for this robot and would not turn it off. And those that did, the other 30 or so that did shut it off, took on average twice as long as the other group that didn't get the command to shut it off. Or rather, they did shut off the robot, but the robot would not plead with them. They just turn it off. They'd flip the switch and walk away. So that was actually a very interesting study, and it kind of shows that maybe we are soon to be getting out of what is called the uncanny valley. Now, that the uncanny valley is that which makes AI or artificial intelligence or robots seem not quite human for us. We know something is off because they are a robot. They are artificial intelligence. They are not interacting in the same way that a human is, or interpreting information like a human can. And if we are seeing this where they are making more advanced emotions, at least mimicking emotions in a robot, then we may have a harder time, turning them off or feeling sympathy and empathy in a way that we technically, I guess, shouldn't, or maybe we should because we're compassionate people. You tell me, you know. But the implications for this, though, are kind of staggering from a cybersecurity side. I mean, imagine if I'm able to hijack a robot, turn it malicious, and then get it to plead with you to do something that you normally wouldn't do. Oh, please give me your password, or please log me in, or, you know, whatever that is. And I am banking on your emotional state, your sympathy, your empathy. And apparently I'm going to be fairly successful like 25% of the time. So that's kind of crazy, but that is the world that we are living in. And that is your artificial intelligence news of the day. And in FCC news, that's the Federal Communications Commission, that is run by President Trump appointee Ajit Pai right now. They have just gone through their annual review. Now, what the annual review is they look at the standards, practices, policies, and all of this that the FCC is basically creating for our telecommunications, our internet, everything like that. And then they are able to change standards if as needed. So the last time we had a major change to our internet service was a few years ago in 2015 under the former chairman, Tom Wheeler, when he decided to move what is classified as broadband, meaning high-speed internet, which was originally at 4 megabit down and 1 megabit up, which by today's standards is completely slow. Moved that up to 25 megabit down and 3 megabit up. Now, there have been calls recently to increase the broadband consideration so that it becomes 100 megabit down, and I think I want to say it was 10 or 20 up, but the 100 megabit down is the most important one. And Ajit Pai, Chairman Pai, Commissioner Pai, basically said, no, we're going to keep this at 25 down, 3 up. And now, obviously, there's a lot of people that are upset about this, although most of us, especially in more urban areas, are getting probably faster broadband than that is. I mean, this is a goal to, one, kind of increase the levels of access for people in, let's say, more rural or remote areas. But what we're not talking about here is the serious issue that we have with our bandwidth right now, in the sense that we have basically a looming bandwidth infrastructure problem, on the horizon. Companies like Comcast and Time Warner and Cox and, you know, whatever the major provider is in your area is having a hard time laying fiber connections, to basically neighborhoods and residences and stuff. And we have this massive increase in our demand for bandwidth. So we are now streaming Netflix at 4K, which takes up a lot of bandwidth compared to when it was just standard high def or not even high def a few years ago. We are spinning up IoT devices. You know, we have, you know, our kids are getting cell phones that need 4G connections and all of this. And these companies are working as fast as they can to respond. And the problem that we have is that something like wireless infrastructure is great. I mean, we're trying to solve the problem by putting in a lot of wireless. So 5G is on the horizon for 2019. It's slated for that right now, and a couple of other things. But at the end of the day, all of your wireless connections eventually go to a wired connection to actually get to the internet, and that is one of the choke points that we have. So we have, let's say, cable modems in our house. We have cable internet connections, or you know, we have standard copper lines from, let's say, AT&T that are trying to, they're trying to replace with fiber, but they can't move fast enough for stuff like this. And so I think that one of the things that Ajit Pai was doing by keeping it at 25.3 was ensuring that the corporations that actually create the infrastructure for us have a little bit of breathing room, at least for one more year, as they continuously try to increase the bandwidth. Now, I'm not worried about things like data centers, or basically those are the locations where our cloud is basically stored. So when you're saving something in the cloud, it's being saved into a data center. They have the ability to be self-contained ecosystems and run as much cabling as they want. But when we're talking about, you know, a neighborhood 10 miles away, you know, from anything else, that is the neighborhood that they're having problems getting, you know, fiber optic to. And we have a continuously expanding population and a continuously expanding demand for things like internet connected IoT devices, mobile phones, laptops, you know, streaming devices for Netflix, Hulu, you know, whatever you use, all of that. And that is something that a lot of people aren't talking about right now. But right now, as it stands, our broadband stays exactly the same as it was before in terms of capability and speed. And that is your FCC news of the day. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And in election voting news, we are actually going to be talking about the state of Georgia. Now, Georgia has electronic voting like many states do, but Georgia is actually only one of four states in the United States that does not give the voter basically a receipt for how they voted on the electronic voting machine. And this is actually becoming a bit of a problem. A lot of investigators have been looking at Georgia because there have been a slew of voting irregularities. People have been dropped from rolls, or voting machines have been mysteriously seizing up all this. And, you know, people are directed from one precinct to another as a result of this. But in one interesting case, there was a voting county called Mud Creek. Like it's Habersham County, and the precinct is Mud Creek. And they had 276 registered voters that turned out for an election. And those 276 voters ended up casting 670 ballots, you know, which is obviously, it is a 243% above and beyond, you know. And just being based in the Chicagoland area, you know, we're kind of known for, you know, politics and corruption, vote early, vote often, all that kind of stuff, you know, the home of Al Capone and everything in Chicago politics. But Georgia's really giving us a run for our money here, because this is absolutely bonkers. And it's been going on for apparently, you know, quite some time. And what we need and what a lot of people are calling for is standardization in voting. Now, our voting system overall, and I've written articles on this and talked about this, is confederated. Some of us use electronic voting. Some of us, you know, punch a hanging chad or draw a line with a marker. That's what my precinct does. And that actually helps, you know, harden us against, let's say, a centralized voting system that hackers could hit and then just change vote totals nationwide. But that still doesn't mean that we shouldn't have voting standards. So you should be able to get a receipt that shows you exactly how you voted, no matter what your method is, you know, and then obviously, you know, nonpartisan verifications and all this kind of stuff. And if we are leaving it up to the states, which is basically what we do now per the Constitution, you know, we end up with problems like 243% voter turnout. So unless the dead are rising in Habersham County and voting in elections, we have a serious problem with Georgia's voting and their electronic computerized voting. So that is a serious problem. And I'm going to keep you guys up to date on this because, you know, we're in election season. So we're always looking for election news. And in cloud vulnerability news, we are actually talking about GoDaddy. Now, if you're not familiar with GoDaddy, they are one of the largest hosting providers probably in the world at this point, with tons of customers. A lot of websites you go to are actually hosted by GoDaddy, or at least GoDaddy is a registrant on that. They also do a whole bunch of different kinds of hosting, email, certificates, all this kind of stuff. Now, we talk about GoDaddy to say that what ended up happening was a vulnerability was exposed that exposed sensitive data on over 31,000 websites that are under GoDaddy's control. Now, the breach actually didn't happen on GoDaddy's watch in the sense that GoDaddy's infrastructure wasn't breached. What ended up happening was an AWS bucket, an Amazon Web Services bucket. Basically, if you're buying a bucket, that means you're getting a cloud instance where you can store data. This bucket was vulnerable, and researchers at an organization or a cybersecurity firm called UpGuard found that this had been exposed. Now, what had been exposed was a 17 megabyte Excel file, Microsoft Excel file, and it had multiple sheets and tens of thousands of rows. Now, this contained data related to the large-scale infrastructure, you know, running in the Amazon cloud, which is GoDaddy, such as high-end configurations, all this kind of stuff. And GoDaddy and Amazon are basically saying, well, this was compiled by a sales individual, you know, for this, but that data was leaked and exposed. And so if you have any goings on with GoDaddy, you're probably going to want to check into that, make sure your passwords are changed, make sure that you weren't part of that, you know, if you have data there. So that is something to know. But, you know, with something like this, if a hacker is able to do this and it's not discovered and they have access to 31,000 sites, it's possible they could deface them or hijack them to reroute you somewhere else. So you think you're going to, you know, legitimatewebsite.com and it's actually taking you to maliciouswebsite.com, that kind of thing. Or infect the sites, advertising, you know, they can insert advertising into it, like adult material, for example, which we see actually quite a bit of with situations like this. And so GoDaddy and Amazon are both completely on it and, you know, locking things down. But this underscores a point that, one, a lot of people just don't know how to configure security in the cloud. And a lot of the data breaches and leaks we see are from Amazon S3 buckets. And I know I've talked about this on the radio show before and in my daily videos and all of that. And it's not Amazon's fault. Amazon gives you tutorials on how to do it. All they're doing is giving you space. They're expecting you to defend it. And they're actually giving you documentation and guides on how to do that. And then people just don't. They either ignore it, or they think they know what they're doing, or the code that they've put up in there is vulnerable in some way, shape, or form. It's a serious, serious problem. But odds are, if you're hearing about some kind of major data breach in the cloud, it's probably being hosted by Amazon because they're the largest hosting provider. So again, GoDaddy's on it. But if you have any dealings with GoDaddy, you definitely want to make sure that you're contacting them and you're making sure that you're changing your passwords and all that kind of stuff. And in social media news, if you use Snapchat, and I will say for full disclosure, I do not use Snapchat, nor would I. Basically, we're going to find out what happens when a major social media platform like Snapchat has their actual proprietary source code, meaning the code that actually developed the app, you know, and their platform gets leaked online. Now, somebody basically claiming to be from Pakistan put up the source code for Snapchat into something called GitHub. Now, GitHub is a repository for programmers and developers to put code up there. They can put things publicly or privately there, and GitHub was recently bought by Microsoft, but it's a huge development platform specifically for like Linux. Now, what ended up happening is, and the reason why we know the code is legitimate, is that Snapchat basically filed a Digital Millennium Copyright Act or DMCA request of GitHub to remove that, claiming that, you know, this is our source code. This can't be up there. It's proprietary to us. And of course, GitHub did respond and take it down. But the mere fact that the code is out there means it could have been downloaded, shared. There could be other copies sitting around in the dark web, which means that hackers possibly now have a deeper understanding of how to break into Snapchat or use it for maliciousness. Or maybe one of the larger, you know, Facebooks of the world, and I'm obviously not accusing them of this, you know, maybe they look at this and say, oh, this is how they did it. We can do this too. We can incorporate this. And now we are running into problems with that. So that is a serious problem for Snapchat on so many different levels. And so if you're using Snapchat, you might want to keep that into consideration, because hackers could possibly be flooding it sooner than later. And not to mention the fact that Snapchat has fended off multiple Federal Trade Commission lawsuits and allegations on basically failing to deliver on promises of security and privacy. So if you're on Snapchat and you send somebody a picture, you can set the picture to basically delete off their phone in 10 minutes or 10 seconds or, you know, whatever it is. You know, so you're giving a person a glimpse. And so naturally what ends up happening, right, is a whole bunch of teenage kids start sending risque photos thinking that they're going to be immediately deleted and that they're safe. But the problem is that these photos were first going to Snapchat servers in the cloud and then being delivered to whoever they were they were intended for, and hackers were able to hit vulnerabilities in the cloud and download and capture cached pictures that were supposedly deleted, and obviously got some very sensitive pictures on some very unfortunate teen girls that had done this. And so they have fended off multiple FTC lawsuits. I'm not a big fan of Snapchat to begin with, for failing to deliver on these promises. But now this just makes it all the more harder. And so we'll see where this goes, with Snapchat. And, you know, hopefully they'll be able to lock the code down, and hopefully they'll be able to make changes to ensure that it's hardened and all of that. But, you know, we'll see where this goes. And in financial tech news, basically, two guys were just convicted. They are U.S. citizens, originally from Ukraine. There were seven total people indicted, but two were just convicted right now, and I believe the other trials are going on. But they were convicted of basically stealing over $100 million from the U.S. stock market. And the way they did it was actually really innovative. Now, there were a total of seven stock traders involved in this scheme thus far. That's what the indictment says, and obviously the conviction of these two. They hired three Ukrainian hackers to not hack the stock market, but actually hit an organization called PR Wire, Business Wire, and another wire. And what they did was they stole the press releases for the companies that they were interested in investing in before, so they could know what the press release was going to say before the world would know it, and then obviously hedge their bets. And the companies they were looking for were things like AMD and GE Health, Weight Watchers of all things, and a few others. And so they knew what to do before the press releases came out, and then would invest or divest or do whatever they wanted to do ahead of time, and made a massive amount of money on this. So it's a rather innovative way to hack the stock market, if you will, without actually hacking the stock market. And so it's very interesting. And it actually kind of reminds me of that old Eddie Murphy movie with Dan Aykroyd called Trading Places, where they steal the press release, or they steal the announcement on trading futures to try to, you know, jack up the cost of the thing. It's pretty much that, but electronic. And these guys actually pulled it off to $100 million. And so I guess the lesson here is crime does pay, even if it's temporary. And we'll see where that goes. And I'll keep you up to date on that. But I thought that was really innovative in terms of what to hack and how to compromise the stock market. And in somewhat Apple news, if you have not heard of a company called TSMC, they are actually one of the largest processors, like CPU processors, manufacturers on the planet. And the reason why they're tied in with Apple is that they just won the Apple contract to make the processors for Apple phones. So that is obviously a very huge deal, because Apple cranks out millions of iPhones every year, and now TSMC is going to do that. So they have been in the process in the last, you know, few weeks, last month or so, of ramping up and spinning up their production for Apple's processors. And then they got hit with a massive ransomware infection. Now, according to TSMC, what ended up happening was a vendor installed software into TSMC, and it didn't go through the normal safety controls and protocol checks. And that was an infected program that quickly spread to 10,000 computers on TSMC's network across multiple locations, manufacturing plants, offices, all this kind of stuff, and basically shut them down to the tune of losing roughly $256 million in productivity, time, and everything else to try to remediate this utterly massive global infection that they had. And what is very interesting is that just coming from the standpoint of a cybersecurity professional that designs infrastructure to defend itself, a manufacturer that is that large with that wide of a scope should not have an outbreak of an infection literally hit every plant, every office, all this globally. Usually it can be contained to the single computer that has the infection, or a department, or even just one facility, as opposed to every facility out there, by running what's called zero trust networking. So if you're installing, let's say, a malicious application that is then going to look across the network to see if it can infect other computers, and then go across, you know, the internet bridge called a VPN to another office, usually what we are doing is we're putting filters in place for that traffic that are checking the traffic for malicious threat. And if it's not seeing traffic that is accepted traffic, it should be blocking it, thus containing the infection. And when you're looking at a corporation as massive as TSMC, to the point where they are making literally every Apple processor, that's a serious problem because clearly they don't have their cybersecurity controls in place. That's kind of unconscionable to me. But this is one of the issues that we have with larger corporations is that so many companies out there pay lip service to data security, or they have some controls in place, but they're not adhered to. We also have the human element with this because, you know, somebody forgot to actually check the program before they installed it, and here we are. So that is a serious, serious problem that TSMC is facing, but also underscores the issues that we have in general with data security in our companies. Now, we're going to see if this delays iPhone production in some way, shape, or form, because, you know, obviously they've lost quite a bit of productivity and a ton of cash, you know, battling this. So from what I know right now, we're not going to see delays on the iPhone release dates or anything like that, but I think TSMC is going to be working overtime to try to make sure they are filling that gap. And that is your somewhat Apple news of the week. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.